Over the last 6 episodes, we've covered the key pieces of medical evidence in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Now, we're finally going to make some judgments about that evidence and put it all together. The big questions that we needed to answer were, 1, is the Warren Report correct about the single bullet theory? 2, were the Zapruder film and the autopsy photos and x-rays all authentic? And 3, were there any shots fired from the front indicating a conspiracy?
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Let's look at the credibility of the single bullet or magic bullet theory. There are 2 issues we need to address. First, whether CE-399, the bullet that's in the National Archives, could possibly be the same bullet that went through Kennedy and Connally. And second, whether it would have been possible for any bullet to go through Kennedy and Connally in the way that the Warren Report described. A few episodes ago, we heard about the chain of custody issues with CE-399. After it was found by Daryl Tomlinson on a stretcher outside the elevators on the ground floor of Parkland Hospital, Tomlinson gave it to the head of hospital security, O.P. Wright, who gave it to Secret Service agent Richard Johnson, who gave it to Secret Service chief James Rowley, who gave it to FBI agent Elmer Todd, who gave it to Robert Frazier at the FBI crime lab. So 6 people had possession of this bullet at one time, but only 2 of them, FBI agents Todd and Frazier, confirmed that CE-399 was the same bullet that they once had in their possession. Tomlinson, Wright, Johnson, and Rowley all could not identify it as the same bullet and said CE-399 didn't look like the one they handled. The Warren Report does not offer any proof that CE-399 came from the stretcher that Connally was using. That fact is presumed by the Warren Commission based on the logic of where else could the bullet have come from? As we heard from Dr. Shaw during a press conference, and we also read in the medical report after Connally's chest surgery, this bullet cannot be inside of Connally's leg at 4 o'clock if it was already found on a stretcher at 1 o'clock. To further confuse matters, it looks like the bullet fragments from Governor Connally's wrist that Nurse Audrey Bell gave to plainclothes federal agents have been conflated in the Warren Report with a full bullet that was in a sealed brown envelope which was given to Officer Bobby Nolan by an unknown nurse. This conclusion is supported by statements from Governor Connally, Officer Nolan, and District Attorney Henry Wade. The Connally wrist fragments eventually made it into evidence as CE-842, which does have Officer Nolan's initials on it. But Nolan denies ever handling fragments, he says he had a full bullet, or interacting with Nurse Bell. The implication is that this mix-up of Nurse Bell with the unknown nurse and Officer Nolan with the plainclothes federal agents may have been done intentionally to make the complete bullet that Officer Nolan had in his possession disappear from the record. Then, there is the condition of CE-399, which is sometimes said to be pristine. The firing tests conducted by the FBI don't help the Warren Report's case. That's because the only bullet that we know was fired into a human cadaver wrist was destroyed, Whereas CE-399 is in very good shape, except for the bottom of it, which is a little deformed. But we would expect that the bullet would be seriously damaged after having gone through Kennedy and then fracturing Connolly's rib and wrist. How could there be less damage to a bullet after hitting two bones than after hitting only one bone? Finally, when you add up the weight of the bullet fragments from Connolly's wrist, plus the fragments that remained in his thigh, the weight may be too heavy to have come from one Carcano bullet. The answer to this question was buried with Governor Connolly when he died. He had a bullet fragment in his leg that was never removed. And if that fragment weighs more than one grain, then CE-399 and its associated fragments are too heavy. But even without knowing how many grains are in Connolly's leg, there's another reason to doubt CE-399. The pieces of bullet fragments that are said to come from it don't match up with the damage to the bullet itself. Because the bullet's in such good shape, you can't pinpoint exactly where on CE-399 these Connolly wrist fragments would have come from. The puzzle pieces just don't fit together. I find it impossible that CE-399 could have been the same single bullet that caused damage to Kennedy and Connolly. The Warren Report continually states things that CE-399 could have done, but it never says what it did do. There's no proof that CE-399 caused the wounds because there's no certainty about where it came from. Remember, it was found on a random stretcher at a time when Connolly still had a bullet in his thigh. Okay, so we got plenty of evidence to rule out CE-399 as possibly being the bullet that hit Kennedy and Connolly. But putting the credibility of CE-399 aside, could the single bullet theory have been pulled off, as the Warren Report says? There are many Parkland doctors who are on record as saying that Kennedy's throat wound, which was later obscured by a tracheotomy, was an entrance wound. If that's true, then the single bullet theory falls apart. What about the wound in Kennedy's back? This is the rear neck wound, if you believe the autopsy, or a right upper back wound, if you believe the Siebert and O'Neill report and the drawing on the autopsy facing sheet. The evidence is all over the place for this wound. Sure, there's a lot of testimony for the idea that the wound was a lower back or right shoulder wound, but the strongest evidence that the neck wound was not at the base of Kennedy's neck and was instead lower and further to the right is the autopsy photo of Kennedy's back. The photo doesn't put the wound as low and far right as conspiracy theorists say, but it's much lower than the base of his neck. Also, Siebert and O'Neill's FBI report said that the back wound, quote, had no point of exit. The Siebert and O'Neill report, and then the two FBI reports that followed it, were all hidden from the public and not included in the exhibits when the Warren Report was first released. But it's also true that rigor mortis could have been the reason that the doctors thought there was no point of exit at the time. The doctors would have had difficulty trying to probe the wound. Still, the fact that the wound was not dissected at all because the doctors were told not to dissect it by military higher-ups is very suspicious. Also, the autopsy doctors presumably were aware of the concept of rigor mortis and would have taken that into account when they said there was, quote, no point of exit. The Warren Report made no final determination about which bullets hit the motorcade. They said it was likely that there were three shots, but made no finding about whether the first or second shot hit the limo. There is general agreement that the third shot caused the fatal wound that hit Kennedy's head. The Warren Report says in the conclusion section, quote, although it is not necessary to any essential findings of the commission to determine just which shot hit Governor Connolly, there is very persuasive evidence from the experts to indicate that the same bullet which pierced the president's throat also caused Governor Connolly's wounds. However, Governor Connolly's testimony and certain other factors have given rise to some difference of opinion as to this probability. The Warren Report goes on to affirm that Oswald was the lone gunman, even if the single bullet theory is not accurate. But Governor Connally was not a believer in the single bullet theory.
Unquestionably, when the first shot was fired, I recognized it as a shot. I thought of nothing else but that it was a rifle shot. I turned to my right. I had time to think. I had time to react. And I turned to my right to look back over my right shoulder to see if I could see anything unusual, and particularly to see if I could catch him out of the corner of my eye. And I was in the process of turning back to look over my left shoulder, and had about come to the point where I was looking straight forward again when I felt the impact of the bullet that hit me.
Connally's belief that he was hit by the second shot is based on his recollection that after he heard the first shot, he had time to turn to his right and then turn to his left before he felt anything. Now, the Zapruder film makes it clear that Kennedy is hit before Connally is hit, but exactly how much earlier he's hit is still disputed. Assuming Kennedy is hit with the first shot and Connally is hit with the second shot, then which shot struck the curb near James Tague? The commission's conclusion was that either the first or second shot missed the limo and caused Tague's injuries, and whichever shot didn't cause Tague's injuries is the one that hit both Kennedy and Connally. When the Warren Commission saw the Zapruder film and the timing of Governor Connally's reaction as compared to President Kennedy's reaction, there was this exchange between Commissioners Alan Dulles and John McCloy. Dulles: "But you would then have the problem, you would think, if Connally had been hit at the same time, would have reacted in the same way and not reacted much later as these pictures show." McCloy: "That is right." Dulles: "Because the wounds would have been inflicted." McCloy: "That is what puzzles me." Dulles: "That is what puzzles me." So there you have it. Two of the Warren commissioners thought that Connally's reaction on the Zapruder film was too late for the same bullet to hit Connally and Kennedy. As I said before, I'm not equipped to decipher what the Zapruder film tells us or doesn't tell us. There are competing experts arguing all kinds of things, but it's interesting that Dulles and McCloy are puzzled by this. They're not the only ones. When asked whether the magic bullet theory was possible by Arlen Specter, Parkland Hospital Dr. Charles Gregory said, quote, "I believe that one would have to concede the possibility, but the probability is much diminished. To pass through the soft tissues of the president would have certainly decelerated the missile to some extent. Having then struck the governor and shattered a rib, it is further decelerated, yet it has presumably retained sufficient energy to smash a wrist bone. Moreover, it escaped the forearm to penetrate at least the skin and fascia of the thigh, and I am not persuaded that this is very probable." During a September 18, 1964 Warren Commission meeting regarding the debate to finalize the single bullet theory, Commissioners Russell, Cooper, and Boggs made their skepticism known. As a compromise, they settled with their fellow commissioners Alan Dulles, Gerald Ford, Earl Warren, and John McCloy on describing the single bullet theory in the report's conclusion as, quote, "persuasive but not compelling." Commission Chief Counsel J. Lee Rankin made no written record of this commission meeting where the single bullet theory was questioned. But we do know that the single bullet theory was debated within the Warren Commission from a recorded phone call between Senator Russell and President Lyndon Johnson.
"Well, they were trying to prove that the same bullet that hit Kennedy first was the one that hit Connally and went through him and through his hand, his bone, into his leg and everything else. Just a lot of stuff that I couldn't hear all the evidence and cross-examine all of them. But I did read the record, and so I just, I don't know. I was the only fellow there that practically suggested any change whatever and what the staff had got up. This staff business always scares me. I like to put my own views down. But we've got you a pretty good report."
"Well, what's, What difference did it make which bullet got Connally?
Well, it don't make much difference, but they said that the commission believed that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. Well, I don't believe it.
I don't either.
And so I couldn't sign it, and I said that Governor Connally testified directly to the contrary, and I'm not going to approve of that. So I finally made them say there was a difference in the commission in that. Part of them believed it. That wasn't so. And, of course, if a fellow was accurate enough to hit Kennedy right in the neck on one shot and knock his head off the next, and when he was leaning up against his wife's head and not even wound her, well, he didn't miss completely with that third shot. According to that theory, he not only missed the whole automobile, but he missed the street. Well, the man's good enough shot to put two bullets right into Kennedy. He didn't miss that whole automobile.
As we just heard, not even President Johnson believed that the single bullet theory was possible. Johnson and Senator Russell wanted to disregard the James Tague injury and have all three bullets hit Kennedy and Connally so that separate bullets would be responsible for Kennedy's back and throat injuries and all of Connally's injuries. This would have then taken away the necessity of the single bullet theory. To be clear, President Johnson and Senator Russell are not conspiracy theorists. They just thought it was more believable that a bullet fragment coming off of the limo hit the concrete near Tague than it was that a single bullet caused all of the damage and remained in such good condition. This audio clip we just played speaks merely to the believability of the single bullet theory by a Warren Commission member and the President of the United States. It doesn't tell us what actually happened. Still, it's quite notable and not often discussed that President Lyndon Johnson was a critic of the single bullet theory. Let's answer the next question. Can we rely on the autopsy photos, the autopsy x-rays, and the Zapruder film? Or were any of those things altered? The autopsy itself has three issues that raise questions. First, the autopsy facing sheet showing an upper right back wound instead of one at the base of Kennedy's neck. Second, the constant interference with standard autopsy procedures by military officers, as Dr. Fink testified during the Clay Shaw trial in New Orleans. And third, the Clark panel report that moved the location of Kennedy's head wound entrance up 4.5 inches. The facing sheet drawing is explained away as a preliminary mistake, but it's a pretty important document, so it's hard for me to believe that the doctor wasn't trying as hard as he could. Also, the facing sheet drawing is consistent with the FBI Seibert and O'Neill report. The fact that the doctors didn't follow basic procedures for an autopsy because the military told them not to is definitely something that raises red flags. History has been deprived of the absolute knowledge of the trajectory of the bullets because the tracks of the bullet wounds were not dissected in the autopsy. Finally, the Clark panel report challenged the credibility of the Warren Report autopsy because it revised the location of Kennedy's head wound by moving it up 4.5 inches from the base of his skull to near the cowlick area on the back of his head. Oh, and the Clark panel doctors happened to find a bullet fragment in an x-ray that was the exact same size of the bullet that Oswald allegedly used. But we're supposed to believe that all of the Bethesda doctors who did the autopsy and the radiologist who examined the x-rays failed to see that 6.5 millimeter fragment. I don't buy the Clark panel revision or the discovery of the 6.5 millimeter bullet fragment. It's one thing to say that the Parkland doctors said the wound was somewhere else and then move it there if there were also other independent facts to support moving the wound position. But the Clark panel, whose findings the HSCA adopted, moved the wound to a place where no witness ever said it was. What about the autopsy photos? Can we rely on them as being authentic? What I don't understand about the photos is that even the doctors who did the autopsy were not allowed to look at them. Why were they not allowed to look at these photos? Autopsy photos are necessary to solve a crime. Why were they not used here? Why were drawings and renderings used in place of the actual autopsy photos? To understand how ridiculous this is, imagine if a prosecutor had photographic evidence, but then said, "I'm not going to use these photos, and instead we'll be relying on someone I hired to draw what the photos show. And no, this person I hired to draw the illustrations has never actually seen the photos, but you should trust me because I'm the government." On top of that, this holier-than-thou argument from the Warren Commission that the reason they never looked at the autopsy photos was out of respect for the Kennedy family, it just doesn't make sense. Were they really trying to solve the crime? If they were, they should have used all available tools. Aside from how shady it is that the Warren Commission never even looks at the autopsy photos, the validity of the photos themselves has been challenged. These challenges are credible until someone specifically debunks them. And saying that the people claiming the autopsy photos are altered must be mistaken or otherwise they're just trying to get rich and famous off of conspiracy books is not the same thing as debunking the substance of their argument. The specific claims must be refuted in a credible way. We need to know why Sondra Spencer, the woman who processed the autopsy photos, told the ARRB that the photos in the National Archives are not the same ones that she processed. She even had the same type of photo paper that the images should be on, and that paper doesn't match. Similarly, why does the autopsy photographer John Stringer tell the ARRB that he never used the kind of film that the official autopsy photos were developed on, and that the brain he photographed was more damaged? Also, Robert Knudsen told his family that he was the only photographer at the autopsy and that he didn't recognize four or five of the photos that he was shown by the HSCA. So with Spencer, Stringer, and Knudsen, we have three people who were involved in the autopsy photos who are on record saying that the official autopsy photos are not the real ones they worked on. And yes, it is true that their memories could have faded over time, but Stringer's recollections were very specific, and Spencer brought physical proof with her in the form of the old photo paper. Dr. David Mantic believes that the autopsy photos of the back of Kennedy's head utilize a photo patch to cover up the area that would have had a hole in the back. He also claims that a similar technique was used for the autopsy x-rays of the back of the skull. Dr. Mantic says that the x-rays showing Kennedy's skull have been altered because the back section is bright white and could not possibly have the thickness attributed to it using the optical densitometer unless the x-rays were forged. Dr. Mantic is an oncologist and radiologist with a physics degree. He's a serious person and, as a radiologist, is an expert in interpreting x-rays. So when I went to the Index of Reclaiming History, the Warren Report Defender Bible written by Vincent Bugliosi, I expected to find a technical refutation of Dr. Mantic's research. Instead, the only thing Bugliosi had to say to refute Dr. Mantic's claims was this, quote, "Dr. Mantic, as is obvious from his scholarly research in the Kennedy case, as well as his background, is a person of considerable intelligence. Not only is he an oncologist, but also a radiologist with a doctorate in physics. How, then, can Mantic and thousands like him in the conspiracy community, many of lesser intellect, end up uttering absurdities like this, as well as countless others throughout the years?" The answer is that within the world of insanity, there is an internal logic. By that, I mean that one can frequently have a perfectly intelligent conversation with an insane person if one is willing to enter that person's world of insane suppositions. Mantic is clearly a very rational person and not insane, but for whatever reason, he is starting out with an insane premise. The internal logic that flows from this premise makes perfect sense. But only from the outside peeping into this mad world can one see how utterly crazy his logical conclusions are. Okay, I get it. Bugliosi doesn't agree that there was a conspiracy. But the question remains, what specifically did Dr. Mantic get wrong in his analysis? Bugliosi did not even attempt to answer that question. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC. It's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click shop by mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. So visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary. We've discussed the autopsy, along with its accompanying photos and x-rays. But was the Zapruder film also potentially altered? Former ARRB employee Doug Horn has laid out exactly how he believes the Zapruder film was altered. He interviewed career officials at NPIC under oath for the ARRB. They explained how the Zapruder film arrived on Saturday night and Brugioni worked on it. Then, Secret Service took it early in the morning on Sunday. On Sunday night, McMahon says that Secret Service agent Bill Smith told him he had just brought the film back from the top-secret Hawkeye Works photo lab in Rochester, New York. Why did all of these career officials make these statements under oath if what they said is not true? But there's another piece of the ARRB Zapruder film saga. The ARRB hired Roland Zavada, an expert on Kodachrome film who worked at Kodak, to analyze the film. Zavada wrote a 150-page report to the ARRB, stating that the Zapruder film in the National Archives is the same one that came from Zapruder's camera, and that the film had not been altered. Some people believe that Kennedy was hit by simultaneous bullets to the head from the front and the back. To me, the Zapruder film doesn't show the blowout in the back of Kennedy's head like you would expect it to if the shot was from the front, though it does show his head snapping backwards. And the thing is, if the shot was from the front, you would also expect Kennedy's body to go violently back and to the left, which is exactly what happened. The record is ultimately not clear as to whether the film was altered. Roland Zavada is a world-class expert, and he says it was not. But it's also true that Dino Brugioni, Homer McMahon, and Ben Hunter were career professionals who testified under oath. And McMahon says the film was delivered from the CIA photo lab that had the most advanced photo editing in the world at the time, the Hawkeye Works facility in Rochester, New York. Either you believe the NPIC employees or Zavada, but they can't both be right. Now we have to tackle the third and most important question. Were there any shots fired from the front? We'll ultimately never know with certainty whether Kennedy's throat wound was an entrance wound or exit wound because the autopsy doctors were not permitted to dissect the wound as would have been standard procedure in a homicide case. Still, a large number of Parkland Hospital doctors are on record as having believed that the throat wound was an entry wound when they saw it. Specifically, Dr. Aiken, Dr. Baxter, Dr. Carrico, Dr. Clark, Dr. Crenshaw, Dr. Jones, Dr. McClelland, Dr. Peters, and Nurse Hinchcliffe. The New York Times reported 2 days after the assassination that the throat wound was an entrance wound. So there's a fair amount of evidence for the throat wound being an entrance wound. The testimony of the Parkland doctors is persuasive because they mostly say the same thing, but it's not conclusive because the question still remains, if the throat wound was an entrance wound, then where did that bullet go? That's the caveat. If you think that the throat wound was an entrance wound, that bullet has to go somewhere and we have no record of it. On the other hand, if everything in the autopsy is correct, then the throat wound must be an exit wound. I lean towards the throat wound being an entrance wound based on the Parkland doctor's testimony, but I don't have much certainty about it because I can't account for where that bullet went if it did enter the front of his neck, because it wasn't found in his body as far as we know. On the 50th anniversary of the assassination, former Parkland Hospital nurse Phyllis Hall said that there was a bullet lodged between Kennedy's ear and his shoulder. Hall said, quote, "I could see a bullet lodged between his ear and his shoulder. It was pointed at its tip and showed no signs of damage. I remember looking at it. There was no blunting of the bullet or scarring around the shell from where it had been fired." Nurse Hall goes on to say, quote, "I'd had a great deal of experience working with gunshot wounds, but I had never seen anything like this before. It was about 1.5 inches long, nothing like the bullets that were later produced. It was taken away, but never have I seen it presented in evidence or heard what happened to it. It remains a mystery." We haven't talked about this bullet at all yet. So if Hall's claim is true, this would be a totally new and different extra bullet. Is there any evidence to support the existence of this additional JFK ear bullet? On the day of the assassination, a memo was written from Alan Belmont of the FBI to FBI Deputy Director Clyde Tolson. The memo said, quote, "I told Special Agent in Charge Shanklin that Secret Service had one of the bullets that struck President Kennedy, and the other is lodged behind the president's ear, and we are arranging to get both of these." FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover also mentioned an intact bullet that came from President Kennedy's head in a phone call a week after the assassination with President Lyndon Johnson.
How many shots were fired?
Three.
Any of them fired at me?
No. All three at the president, and we have them. Two of the shots fired at the president were splinted, but they had characteristics on them so that our ballistic expert was able to prove that they were fired by this gun. The third shot, which hit the president, he was hit by the first and the third. The second shot hit the governor. The third shot is a complete bullet that wasn't shattered, and that rolled out of the president's head. It tore a large part of the president's head off. And in trying to massage his heart at the hospital, on the way to the hospital, they apparently loosened that, and that fell onto the stretcher. And we recovered that, and we have that.
So from that, it sounds like the bullet that Hoover is referencing that came out during cardiac massage is the same one that Seibert and O'Neill and a lot of the doctors and medical professionals at Bethesda thought came out of Kennedy's back during a cardiac massage. This puts even more doubt about CE-399 as being the legitimate single or magic bullet, because the Warren report says that the bullet came from Connolly's stretcher after coming out of his thigh. The Warren report doesn't say anything about a bullet being found on Kennedy's stretcher. But Hoover says, quote, "We recovered that. We have that." Sounds like he's talking about having this bullet that he says came out of Kennedy's head. I don't know what to make of this evidence of another bullet, but it's not nothing. Hoover and Belmont wouldn't say it if there wasn't a reason to. And Nurse Hall also lends credibility to this idea. Although we do have to wonder why no other doctors or nurses in Dallas saw this mysterious bullet behind President Kennedy's ear that was seen by Nurse Hall. Josiah Thompson was one of the original researchers and authors on the Kennedy assassination. After reporting on the assassination for Life magazine on assignment, he published a book with his findings called 6 Seconds in Dallas in 1967. Thompson has written a new book that documents his research since then called Last Second in Dallas. In this book, Thompson puts forth a novel theory about a second shot hitting Kennedy's head from behind after the first shot already hit Kennedy's head from the front. This last second shot would explain how there could be bullet fragments in the front seat and is consistent with a separate headshot from the front as well. Thompson had previously measured Kennedy's head movement in between each Zapruder frame so that he could see when there were any noticeable changes. The time period where there is the biggest movement in Kennedy's head, other than Zapruder frame 313, when the first headshot hits, is in frames 329 and 330, which is 7/10 of a second after the infamous headshot. In those frames, you can also see Kennedy's head suddenly snap forward. We don't know if that's from a bullet, but it could be. If this was just a guy talking about the Zapruder film, I wouldn't have even mentioned it in this podcast. But it's not just some guy, it's Josiah Thompson, who is known in the conspiracy research world to be very responsible. And the possibility of Thompson's theory is also supported by the written report of the HSCA's medical panel, which said, quote, "Dr. Michael Bodden, chairman of the HSCA's forensic pathology panel, acknowledged there was a possibility, although highly remote, that the head wound depicted in Zapruder frame 312 could have been caused by a shot fired from the grassy knoll, and that the medical evidence of it had been destroyed by a shot from the rear a fraction of a second later. The significance of this was the realization that it could mean that the president's fatal head wound was caused by the shooter from the grassy knoll and not Oswald." The HSCA report continues, quote, "For that bullet to have destroyed the medical evidence of the president being hit at Zapruder frame 312 from a shot fired from the grassy knoll, it would had to have struck the rear of the president's head at Zapruder frames 328 and 329 by a shot fired from behind." Josiah Thompson's theory about a last-second rear headshot does make sense. I don't know if it happened, but it does make sense. It would explain the bullet fragments found in the front seat. And the Zapruder film, which, admittedly, I am no expert at interpreting, does match up with what Thompson says. But most importantly, Dr. Michael Bodden said that if there was a shot from the grassy knoll, there would have to be this rear headshot that happened at about the exact time that Thompson puts the shot. Now, this claim by Dr. Bodden that there could have been a grassy knoll shooter, but only if there was a last-second rear headshot, did not go unnoticed. Dr. Bodden was scheduled to respond to questions before the HSCA about this theoretical possibility on December 29th of 1978. But because of the time spent on acoustical evidence, Dr. Bodden's scheduled appearance before the committee was canceled and never rescheduled. Conspiracy theorists pretty much unanimously believe that the shot that hit Kennedy's head was from the right front. But does the evidence support that? Dr. Malcolm Perry, the presiding surgeon, gave a press conference where he said, quote, "A bullet struck him in the front as he faced his assailant." Now, Dr. Perry later recanted that statement, but then again, we also have the James Gokenauer story about how Secret Service agent Elmer Moore confessed to him that he pressured Dr. Perry to publicly take back what he said in that press conference about the shot coming from the front. The medical evidence we found in support of a right front headshot is that the vast majority of eyewitnesses in Dallas, including doctors and nurses, said that the head wound was on the back right side of Kennedy's head, including Dr. Crenshaw, Dr. Clark, Dr. Peters, Dr. Perry, Dr. Jones, and most notably, Dr. McClelland, who was the doctor physically closest to the back of Kennedy's head while he was being treated. Dr. McClelland said that the wound was in the lower back right part of Kennedy's head, and the final official word from the Dallas doctors in the form of their written medical report summary says that the head wound was, quote, "in the occipital region of the skull," which is the back of the skull, not the parietal or side region that was alleged by the Warren Report. Now, the official counts vary, but according to researchers Dr. Gary Aguilar and Kathy Cunningham, the earliest statements of at least 43 people who saw the head wound said that it was in the right rear of the president's head. Warren Report defenders are quick to point out that Parkland doctors were not looking for things an autopsy doctor would look for. And to the extent they were, those doctors must have been mistaken. Even good people can make mistakes under pressure. But for the majority of doctors to have consistently identified the wound and have been wrong, there would have either had to be some coordination among them or a mass hallucination for them to all be saying the same thing, which is not true. On top of the doctors, there are other witnesses like Paul O'Connor, James Jenkins, Al Wright, Dennis David, Joe O'Donnell, and Tom Robinson, who are on the record saying that the head wound was one that entered in the front and exited out the back of Kennedy's head. And then there's the video of the press conference at Parkland Hospital, where Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff put his finger against his right temple and said, quote, "The president died of a gunshot straight to the brain." Wouldn't Kilduff have put his finger on the back of his head if the entrance wound was thought to be from the back? The strongest arguments against the word of the Parkland doctors are the autopsy photos, and the autopsy x-rays. The autopsy itself is supported by the sworn testimony of the autopsy doctors, Humes, Fink, and Boswell. So if you think that the autopsy is not truthful, you also have to believe that Humes, Fink, and Boswell were not being truthful. But why would Humes, Fink, and Boswell lie under oath? Conspiracy theorists say that they must have been pressured to lie due to the chain of command, but that's just speculation. We don't have any proof that any of these doctors lied or were forced to lie, But we do have proof that the doctors were pressured to not follow standard procedure during the autopsy. If we knew with certainty that the autopsy, the photographs, and the x-rays were credible, it would be much easier to dismiss all the people on the record saying that Kennedy's head wound entered from the front and exited from the rear. But even assuming all of those documents are completely legit, it still doesn't explain the anomaly of the Dallas doctors overwhelmingly saying the headshot came from the front with a large wound in the back of Kennedy's head. So what do you do? This is one of the key points in the case where different people make different inferences based on what they think this information means. There are competing inferences based on how you answer these questions. How much weight do you put on official records? Do you believe there is any scenario where the FBI and a commission led by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court would intentionally fabricate information or be gullible enough to fall for falsified documents? Or is it more likely that a lot of Parkland doctors just misremembered what the headshot looked like? Is anyone who testifies to information consistent with a conspiracy telling the truth? And if not, how do you account for there being so many of them? Do they all just want to be famous and cash in on book deals? The way that you answer these questions dictates the conclusion you reach as to whether the Warren Report got it right on the medical evidence. My final conclusions regarding the medical evidence in the assassination of President Kennedy are as follows. 1. I think that it's highly unlikely that CE-399 was the bullet that caused the damage to Kennedy and Connolly. Most of the people who handled the bullet said that it didn't look like CE-399, and even more significantly, the bullet was still in Connolly's leg at the time CE-399 was found on a random stretcher. If it's true that the same bullet went through both President Kennedy and Governor Connolly, it's not CE-399. 2. It's also highly unlikely that the same bullet that hit President Kennedy caused all of Governor Connolly's wounds. The Seibert and O'Neill report, Admiral Berkeley's death certificate, and the autopsy photo of Kennedy's back wound, among other evidence, demonstrate that the back wound is too low for the front neck wound to be an exit wound. 3. Given everything that we reviewed, while I'm not sure exactly what happened, I believe that it's more likely that the autopsy photos and x-rays were altered than it is that 43 doctors, nurses, and medical professionals were all mistaken about their initial recollections of seeing a lower back head wound. Without a doubt, this is one of the biggest splits in inference points between Warren Report critics and Warren Report defenders. I understand that what I'm alleging has serious implications. I base my finding on the testimony of the Parkland doctors, the Seibert and O'Neill report, and the bizarre refusal to allow the autopsy doctors to have access to the autopsy photos. I understand that this is a serious and contentious claim, and I'm open to information that would prove the autopsy photographs and x-rays are authentic. But I haven't seen it yet. And 4, the Zapruder film could have been altered, but I don't know whether it was or not. Rolando Zavada's report stating that it was not altered really makes this a cloudy issue. The Zapruder film alteration is still not impossible because you have the testimony of McMahon, Hunter, and Brugioni, and the question of why would they all lie? Next time on Solving JFK, we'll look at whether there were holes in the windshield of the limo, the timing of the shots, whether the limo came to a stop in Dealey Plaza, and whether Oswald had the shooting skills to pull off the shots that he was accused of firing by the Warren Commission. If you heard anything on this episode that lacks context or you think is incorrect, please let us know. You can email solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide a citation, and we'll consider it for a future rebuttal episode.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.